This podcast is brought to you by the Vancouver Sun.
You're listening to an episode of Unedited with Vancouver Sun Arts and Entertainment editor and reporter Francois Marchand.
Howe is the lead guitarist for a British progressive rock band, Yes. He's been a member of the band since 1970 and has played on and off with the band over the last 4 to 5 decades. We recently talked to Steve Howe ahead of a concert taking place at the Hard Rock Casino in Vancouver on September 12th, and we discussed, among other things, the passing of founding member and bassist Chris Squire, and recording some of those 70s classic Yes albums. First of all, obviously, you're coming to Vancouver, playing at the Hard Rock Casino, if I'm not mistaken. At the tail end of this tour, and obviously the big element that's missing this time around is Chris. The last time we saw you guys at the Queen Elizabeth Theatre in Vancouver, Chris was here, and you guys performed 3 albums in their entirety. Tell me how it feels to not have Chris on this tour.
Well, I mean, it feels how you would expect it to feel. You know, I mean, obviously, we unlike the public, we weren't as shocked because we saw Chris's situation getting worse and worse, and his immune system, you know, and all that kind of thing starting to accumulate, that he wasn't strong enough to withstand the treatment he was having, you know, the whole syndrome of the treatment versus one's own stamina and things like that. So we saw it. I mean, obviously we're very sad, and, and you know, basically the way we deal with it is we created an intro to the show that pays tribute to Chris. So in a way, before we do anything, we pay tribute, and then we carry on, you know, because irrespective of why somebody isn't in the band, well, particularly seriously, obviously, if somebody's passed away, but as Peter Banks did some years back, we basically, you know, like in life itself, even if you lose your loved one, you do actually have to find a way of carrying on. And, and in a way, the music has a healing element, and carrying on with Chris in mind is also a worthy challenge. So that's basically what we're doing. We're carrying on, but we have great respect and regard for the memory of Chris. So that's what we're doing.
Mm-hmm. Can you tell me about the first time you met Chris and what memories you have of that?
Well, him and John had decided to invite me to kind of audition for Yes back in 1970, in I think it was in January or something. So Chris called me and said, you don't know me, but I've seen you play, and you're in Tomorrow and the other groups you're in, and you know, John and I would like to write you down to play. And so the first time we met was a few days later, in a place called Barnes, in near the River Thames. We met at the manager's house. We were in a small basement, and I walked in, and you know, there was the band I was about to join. And you know, Chris was one of, you know, 4 standout musicians that I met all at the same time. You know, Bill Bruford and John Anderson, Tony Kaye, and Chris Squire. I mean, it was quite formidable. And, you know, I was excited because I've been looking for a band who could play, and wanted to get somewhere by the music and not really so much the posy, showy, flashiness of most rock bands at that time. So I was delighted. And at that time, even though there was stage presence, you know, it was fairly under control. So yeah, that's how we met. That's when we met.
Mm-hmm. What do you think made his sound so important. I mean, I listened to Close to the Edge yesterday, and there's such an intricate interplay between, you know, your guitar lines right off the bat at the beginning and that incredible rumble that comes out of that bass. There was such a chemistry between you guys. Do you think that was unique, or was there a certain kind of magic between you guys that popped out at that time?
Well, I mean, chemistry isn't arranged, you know. It is there, you know, for you to experience, you know. And Chris and I, as much as John and I mean, John and I had a lot of chemistry. We started writing, you know, things like Roundabout and Tales from Telegraphic Oceans and Close to the Edge and Awake. And, you know, so there was a lot of chemistry within, yes. There was a lot to balance, in a way, between the different members who were prone to fall out about the slightest accent, or the is it going to be an E or an E flat? You know, I mean, we argued about the finer details of life, and that was the creative process. So in a way, that debate was always going on. And I don't think Chris and I really noticed in the early 70s that it was so keyed around the guitar and bass, but actually it was, you know. And you know, you can't get away from it in Heart of the Sunrise. You can't get away from it most of the time, but I mean, that's a good and exciting ingredient that Yes had, but no more so than, you know, no more or less so than in other fields in the music, because obviously, really, if you look at it, the bass and drums, up, you know, including Close to the Edge, it was so intricate, and they debated a great deal about how. So there was a lot of locking in.
Do you feel like, I mean, you mentioned something about Yes not being the flashiest of rock bands back in the early 70s, but do you feel like that non-flashiness on stage was maybe something that carried on into the studio, and that's where technicality was maybe the flashy element? There was such an arms race in the early 70s as far as making concept sides for albums, Close to the Edge being one. Let's say ELP's Tarkus being another one, Floyd with Echoes, Supper's Ready from Genesis, these 20-minute suites. Were you guys conscious of wanting to build something that would maybe, I don't know, compete? I don't like to use the word compete, but, you know, that would stack up against all these other ones.
I mean, look, we were pretty young and we were adventurous and we wanted to make music. We didn't make music because we wanted to make it complex or because we didn't, you know. I mean, we just basically did what we thought was right, and to the level when people accused us of being, well, I mean, we've been accused of being everything, you know, indulgent, flashy, you know, too much, you know, musicianship on show and all that kind of stuff. We just kind of laughed and said, you know, get out of here. We're just doing what we do. And I think that's what I was really referring to, was as the years went by, flashiness on stage did become a feature, you know, and it was a feature. And I guess, you know, at times it was okay, and other times I didn't like it. You know, I mean, I used to be a guitarist who just kind of stood there, like I do some nights now. Some nights I just want to play music, you know. I don't really want to be so committed to being a performer. But other nights I enjoy performing, you know. I enjoy moving about and kind of nodding about and things like that. So, I mean, it is a choice, you know, all musicians have, and it's the same choice we had in the music, you know, how busy or how complex or what was going on. I mean, some stuff we did was pretty complex, but, I mean, you know, I think there's a context that we miss a great deal when we talk about our music or the music of, you know, of the generation, like you recited all those different bands who were similar to us. Yeah, we had ambitions, you know, we wanted to beat music, although it didn't seem such a crime, you know, but it became a somewhat crime when the scene changed and people like Three Chords and a guitar out of tune.
Right.
I mean, when people like that, then obviously what we were doing was extreme. But in fact, what we were doing was nothing compared to the complexity of classical music or jazz. So when you listen to Mozart's Piano Concerto number 19 and realize that he wrote not only 19, but he wrote the other ones after 19, you realize that classical music is way more complex than any other kind of music. And therefore, you know, the accusations about us were really quite nebulous, because we basically did what we did, but if you want complexity, you know, listen to Stravinsky or even Dvorak. You know, there's a context where rock music's supposed to be, you know, it's just got to stay simple. We didn't believe in that. We didn't believe it should stay three chords and occasionally a fourth, you know, and we didn't agree with that.
Yeah. Well, speaking of classical music, I mean, I want to talk about your style of guitar playing. First of all, your guitar selection when you started out was slightly different than other people playing the hollow body guitar. And then there's something about the way you built your guitar playing consisting of lines and chords combined. Maybe you can tell me about how you developed your guitar playing style.
Well, I mean, it's taken 55 years, so it'll take more than 55 seconds.
Fair enough, yeah.
But, I mean, I can't really explain that. I mean, you know, I mean, it's like, do you ask an artist how he puts his brush on the canvas? I mean, he puts his brush on the canvas. And that's basically what I do on the guitar, is I play in the guitar, much like we were talking about how Yes had some individual qualities, and you know, I kind of hoped I might have some individual qualities, but I wasn't that aware of it at first. I just wanted to play the guitar, you know. I mean, it was just being inspired by Chet Atkins or Wes Montgomery or Charlie Christian or Julian Bream, you know. I mean, there were so many great guitars that you couldn't help being inspired, but all I did was Chet just kind of instructed me by listening to him. It kind of instructed me to think wide, you know, to think about Spanish guitar, to think about steel guitar, to think about the whole family of guitar, not just one particular kind of guitar. I didn't want to be locked down like I didn't in school. I didn't want to be locked down to hours in a smelly classroom. I basically wanted to be free, and I think the way a musician experiences freedom is to take that as far as they can, and I've always done that. I've always thought, you know, that I was free to experiment, you know, and that's, in the 60s there was a lot of experimentation, because Tomorrow was in fact a very, very strong group. The record doesn't indicate it so much, but we were a mad kind of racy, quite experimental band that really opened the door for me in Yes. In fact, you know, that's why I joined Yes, really, was because they'd seen me in Tomorrow. And then later John saw me in a group called Bodas, which was really a songwriting kind of band. So when I joined Yes, I was determined that Yes should play our own music. I think playing your own music is your chance to have your own sound. I mean, it's not so easy playing other people's music and expecting your sound to resonate. You know, I think that Yes believed that, and I did, believe that, you know, to get your sound across, you ought to have original music as well. So that whole, when I joined Yes, I said, like, I don't think this band should do covers anymore. You know, they said, well, yeah, we'd like to stop that. You know, so in a way, they did brilliantly, and we did very well with America to arrange other people's music. We could bring our skills to it, and you know, there was a lot of combustious thought going on, and that's basically the style that I play, especially when I bring acoustic into it, which I did do, you know, with things like Roundabout and other things. I wanted to interplay those sounds. I wanted to be many things at once, if you like, maybe too many things, but there was a challenge. That was my destiny, was to try to cover the kind of gambit of guitar styles that anybody and everybody could do. You know, sometimes I do play bluesy. Sometimes, like, Drama is a bit heavy metal. You know, I haven't avoided anything on purpose. It just so happens that most probably heavy metal and blues aren't the main feature of what I do, but that doesn't mean to say they're not there. And they're not, you know, I don't purposely avoid it. I just use it when called up. So I enjoy the mix of styles and not being one guitarist. You know, just one guitarist, one sound, one approach. Because I got very tired of blues cliches, because every guitarist I could hear in the late 60s was really going, you know, they were all doing blues. And I was like, what has happened? I mean, guitar is not blues. Rock guitar is not blues guitar. They're two different fields. You know, and if you want to tap into B.B. King, great. You know, but I was tapping into Big Bill Brunsey. Funny enough, a lot of bees as well. But Big Bill Brunsey was definitely taking me places I wanted to go, and electric blues weren't. So that was my leaning on blues. But basically it was jazz and classical and folk and, you know, just the whole gambit. I was just receptive.
Yeah. Last year I saw a concert by two DJs, DJ Shadow and Cut Chemist in Vancouver, and they were touring a collection of albums that used to belong to Afrika Bambaataa in New York City. One of the cornerstone tunes in that set was Owner of a Lonely Heart, because it has that breakbeat aspect to it. So we're talking about the different genres that guitar can emulate or can be inspired from. But Owner of a Lonely Heart is basically a hip-hop song in their mind. How do you see that song nowadays?
I'm not sure quite what to say. I mean, are you talking about us being sampled by hip-hoppers? You
know? That song became like heavily sampled by hip-hop because of
its
rhythm. Well, I
didn't notice that too much because, as you might know, I wasn't on that record. So that's an era of, yes, you know, Big Generation, mm-hmm. Talk, 90125. I was doing other things. And, mm-hmm. and I thought Yes were, changing, you know, but that's what happens when, you know, it changed when Bill left. It changed, you know, when Rick Wakeman left. And so basically the Yes was always capable of change. So the fact that song would fall in to yet another kind of genre later, I've really got no comment on it, you know, because it's arm's length.
Right. And it's not a song that comes back in sets these days, is it? Or does it get
we
played?
We play it at the moment. We didn't play it on the three album tour set most probably, but we play it now because we're doing a sort of selection show with Toto because that's what seems appropriate. Hour and a half. Mm-hmm. We can't use up half the time on an album and then only half the time on other music. So that's what we're doing at the moment.
Mm-hmm. Tell me about the makeup of the band right now. Billy Sherwood taking Chris's place. John Davison doing vocals still. How is that band working out together on this tour?
Well, I mean, you know, we've done about, I don't know, 15 shows or something. I mean, mm-hmm. it's quite a new baby, if you like.
Yeah.
But in a way, it doesn't particularly feel like that. Not only has Billy returned to the band after Open Your Eyes, the Ladder era, he's doing a very different job now, and he's doing it very well, so that's pleasing us. Basically, we threw ourselves in the deep end, really, by believing that it was better to go on than to stop. You know, a stop was a big hole, and to go on was a big challenge. Mm-hmm. But, you know, so Billy's helping us do that, but it obviously takes a lot of internal combustion to help Billy do it, and as well as Billy's helping us do it. I mean, we just feel at ease with it. You know, it's something that maybe we felt a lot better after the first show about. We were surprised and delighted how supportive fans were, and the way we shaped the show seems to let them know that, you know, we care very much about Chris, but also we care about carrying on what Chris and John Anderson started, you know, back in 1968. So, it's very deep that Chris isn't here for the reason that he isn't, but also it's pretty deep that the other guys aren't here for the reasons that they're not here, you know. You know, we met Patrick Mraz the other night in Clearwater, you know, and, you know, we have some contact with John and Anderson, and basically, you know, we ought to see this group as a sort of expanded family.
Yeah, it is. So many people have been involved, and Chris being the only one that's been there for all of the albums.
That is important, but it doesn't change everything.
Absolutely,
but it is an amazing fact about his presence in the group.
Yeah. Two more questions, Steve, and then I'll let you go. And again, thank you for doing this. Obviously, you're a busy man all the time, even outside of Yes, and I understand that you and your two sons collaborate musically, and I want to know how that feels to be working with, we talked about extended family, with actual family musically.
Yeah. Well, I mean, Dylan's been working with me since 1993, really, when he did the drumming on The Grand Scheme of Things. On his terms, when he was ready, he started helping me on albums, and, you know, we've done some surprising things. I've released an anthology recently on Rhino, the first of two, actually. Mm-hmm. This one's about my solo work. And, of course, Dylan's all over it because he's done so much drumming for me. Now, Virgil's a little younger, and we've done some things, and he's played keyboards and things like this. So I've experienced it. I mean, in the beginning of it, it's all a win-win situation. You know, it's yeah. like, well, this is great, not only because, hey, I'm hanging out with my sons, and they're playing, and Dylan and Virgil, you know, Dylan's focused exclusively on drumming, and he's really, really phenomenal drummer. And Virgil has broadened his horizon, and he's doing drumming and keyboard play, and he writes some nice music. So I do have projects with both of them running at the moment that are near completion. Mm-hmm. And, of course, the Steve Howe Trio, you know, features Ross Stanley and Dylan. And it's a kind of simplistic band that also has its complexities because I kind of jump over the gate a little bit more into the jazz world. The new record that isn't titled yet, that isn't quite finished yet, is original music, and some by a surprising ex-member of Yes, actually.
Oh,
so
okay.
That's a nice approach. We're just kind of finishing up on that. I mean, everything that seems simple at first never is simple. So mm-hmm. it's not as simple as it seems. It's as rewarding as it can be, and it's very nice, you know, to do that. But also, you kind of meet some of the same obstacles you meet in life, you know, when you try and work with people in the family.
Yeah.
You have to be kind of very appreciative of their time and effort, and that's what I try to do. But also, you know, you have to give things time. You have to find time to do things too. So that's another issue that call on time is. So I'm always being kind of pushed and pulled. Really, am I going to give up more time in Yes to do? This is why I left Asia. You know, when
right.
we reformed in 2007. I mean, I left I think it was 2012 because just couldn't deal with not having any time for my solo projects anymore because they are very, very important to me. Not only the ones I do with Dylan and Virgil, but also my other projects. So basically, it has to be a compromise in some way because of the demands and the success of Yes, it kind of, I wouldn't say cast a shadow, but it casts a proposal across what you can do outside of the group, you know. And I love doing, like in April I did a UK solo tour where I play on my own, you know, because I need that space, you know, as a musician, I need that space. So then building time where I'm working with the highly complex Yes, you know, with all its facets and angles and demands and worries. Also, you know, building time to work with Dylan on the trio and Virgil on a project we're doing together. So basically, it's demanding. Mm-hmm. Of course, I love them, and you know, I relish the time that we can wrap things up on a project and release it. You know, yeah. It's very exciting.
Yeah, you said something about a surprise member of Yes. I don't know. Do you don't want to reveal that yet, or
no?
That's fair. I thought I'd ask anyway, just in case.
As I say, the surprise is a writer. That's all I can say.
Fair enough. We'll leave it at that. The fans will have to try and figure that out. The final question, Stephen, again, thank you for doing this. There's an area just northwest of Vancouver called Howe Sound. Have you ever been there?
Mm. Have I ever been there? I've tried to get there. I called my label Howe Sound because it's so appropriate. You know, I've seen lots of pictures. I've got lots of pictures of Howe Sound.
Oh, really?
I can't actually remember if I've seen it in person, but basically, I feel very at home in Canada. I think there's a strong European-British connection, obviously. There is.
Mm-hmm.
It's undeniable with Canada. And, you know, I've got friends in Toronto who I really enjoy. I mean, when I get to Toronto, I mean, I have a great time, you know, mm-hmm. I mean, with people I know. And they're in different fields. They're family friends and they're kind of, you know, other sorts of friends. I have a really great time. So I guess I'd like to explore. I think... Exploring is kind of good, but the only trouble is I've done so much touring that exploring is similar to touring. And to get in a car, and I saw a program about guys, you know, a couple of rock musicians taking a drive, And they've obviously done masses of that on tour. So there's a to get my time again. You know, I was talking about the musical time. You know, to do projects. And also to get the free time to kind of explore parts of the world, got unrealistic, really. Because, yeah. You know, because of the amount of travel I do in touring, it makes me very tentative about doing that for pleasure, because it's not a pleasure. It's part of my work. And I do an immense amount of miles, which, you know, I willingly do because that's my call. That's my calling. So, yeah, house sound, it does stick out. It is quite predominant, and, you know, I would love to see it, but sufficient to say that for now I've got pictures of it.
That's good. There's a brewery.
One of them's hanging in my house here, where I can see it. That's house sound.
Yeah.
Wordplay is fascinating. I mean, I had a fairly dreary education, and my vocabulary was really quite, you know, quite basic when I left. But I had a belief as a young person that knowledge was really important, but not necessarily what they wanted to throw down my throat at school, but the actual learning about life, you know. And I've done that to as much as I can, and as I say, places like House Sound that I'd like to visit, you know, I do have regrets, you know, that I don't get a chance to see it. But knowing it's there and stealing the title for my label is as good as it gets.
If anything, there's a very good brewery up there in House Sound, and it's called House Sound Brewery. And if you're beer fan, maybe you should try it out. It's actually quite delicious. So,
well, somebody said this to me yesterday, that only once have they seen me drink a beer. I bought a beer for a friend, and they were saying to me how that's the only beer they've ever seen. I don't drink, and most of the things one doesn't do, you don't do them because they don't work. You know, I'm a vegetarian, and you can tell that meat and fish don't work. But and it's the same with beer. It doesn't work. It's too fizzy, and it makes my head spin. But you know, once or twice a year, you know, I'll indulge in a nice bottle of wine, a white wine, a nice cool French, you know, Courton Charlemagne or something, but that's a rarity, and I like that, because for so many people, drinking is just part of their social, but they don't notice how that social thing is most probably tipping them a bit over the edge. But each to our own, you know, and I make choices, and I think making choices empowers you, you know, because obviously, it's bloody obvious, if you don't make choices about yourself, you're not empowered. You know, you haven't made a choice. So you basically are a whim. You're just flapping about in the wind, I think. And when I, all that time ago, 40 years ago, over 40 years ago, I decided to be vegetarian, it really tightened my game up. It really tightened my self-control, my, you know, I'm not a goody-goody, you know, I'm not an angel. But I've had some control, and food and drink and those kind of things are, you know, just thrown at us. I mean, look at the advertising in America for food. I mean, the program ended. I was quite enjoying a program. And the first image that came up was a giant hamburger with cheese dripping out of it. I mean, the full screen. So, you know, as a vegetarian, I noticed those things. And I think to myself, you know, what they're doing is they're just playing about with people. You know, advertising is just a stronghold. And it's your choice.
Yeah.
Back away, stand away, turn it off. Don't do it, and do what's right for you. So letting your body feel what your body likes, and if it doesn't like it, you know, I hear people coughing and they don't stop to think why. You know, I hear people, I see people not looking good in the morning, and they don't stop and ask why. You know, they're all screwed up and they don't feel good. You know, well, hang on, what were you doing late last night? You know, what were you up to? You know, where were you? So I'm very pleased that it's empowering, you know, to spread the idea that it's empowering to make decisions, and it's very weakening if you don't. So if you've got something to do, wake up and say, you know, as they used to say, snobbish, I don't drink coffee.
Wow.
That sounds like I'm a complete nerd. But basically, the things that just don't work, I don't do them. But it's like that in music, you know, there's things that don't work for me in music, and there's things that do. So, you know, roll on Chet Atkins and a bit of country picking, and I'm a happy guy.
There you go. Words of wisdom from Steve Howe. Sir, thank you very much. We'll see you in Vancouver.
Words of wisdom. All right, François, thanks very much. And I hope it all goes well. Edit a little, won't you, please?
Thank you.
All right, then. See you up in Vancouver, I hope.
See you soon. Bye-bye.
Okay, bye.
Take a straight and stronger course to the corner of your life. Make the White Queen run so fast. She hasn't got time to make you a wife. It's time, in time with your Thailandish news. It's captured for the Queen to use. Move me on to any black square. Use me
as. You've been listening to an episode of Unedited with Vancouver Sun Arts and Entertainment editor and reporter Francois Marchand. Follow Francois on Twitter at FMarchandVS or read his blog on VancouverSun.com.